What do you think that these precious metals are screaming to the Bitcoin market?
Bitcoin down more than 22%.
I think it's definitely screaming at the thesis is.
Saylor actually had a unique little point here when he was interviewing with Danny Knowles.
Why don't you actually put the focus upon the people that make the investment decision? The companies don't determine the price their stock trades at.
Now, you're inside all of this, so I'm curious, how do you view essentially the other Bitcoin treasury companies now coming in?
Just because other people have bought Bitcoin and owned, no, if you have zero Bitcoin, like you probably need Bitcoin more than anybody else. I think that that's going to accelerate as we approach 2035. I'd want to own way more Bitcoin than everyone else.
It's 10 million by Q1 of 2035, is that correct?
We'll never be able to create more than 21 million Bitcoin. And so, I, you know, related to the $10 million price prediction in 2035 is...
Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, recurring guest now, Joe Burnett, who is now VP of Bitcoin strategy over at Strive. So a lot has changed since the last time we have spoke, but something very interesting obviously developed all through last year and made waves, and it's the Bitcoin treasury strategy. So we've seen so many different Bitcoin companies, or now just regular companies, go and buy Bitcoin. And Saylor actually had a unique little point here when he was interviewing with Danny Knowles not too long ago, that Bitcoin companies shouldn't be viewed at as competing against strategy or anything else. They should be viewed at as competing against other companies within their niche. Now, you're inside all of this, so I'm curious, how do you view essentially the other Bitcoin treasury companies now coming in and the development of this movement and maybe a little bit of the rockiness that kind of came with it within this past calendar year?
Yeah. Well, Brandon, first, thanks for having me back on. Great show. Excited to be here. And starting off, I guess, with the hot topic with, you know, Bitcoin treasury companies. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different places to start. One I can say is like, which is kind of the point of, you know, that Saylor was making on that podcast, is, are Bitcoin treasury companies competing against each other? And like, the answer is kind of like, I would say yes and no. You know, one way that I've thought about it in the past is like, if you are, you know, just like an individual, like we're not like, in a way, are we competing against each other to accumulate more Bitcoin for ourselves? Like, yes, but like, it's a positive sum game. Like, we can both win together and accumulate more wealth, real wealth, in terms of like what our Bitcoin can buy. The more people that actually buy Bitcoin, like, money is a network good, which means as the network grows, everyone kind of wins. And so in that sense, you know, it's good for other companies to buy Bitcoin. And, you know, if you're, for example, Semler Scientific, initially a healthcare company, you know, and I believe in 2021, Semler, before Semler adopted any sort of Bitcoin strategy whatsoever, Semler was a $1 billion healthcare business, you know, perfectly normal business, publicly traded, you know, making, you know, a good bit of free cash flow, and business was great. And, you know, it's, you know, Semler is still a healthcare business, and they bought Bitcoin on the balance sheet. And so, and obviously Strive then acquired Semler. And so it's like, any company that either has free cash flow can buy Bitcoin. Any company that, you know, is stuck or a zombie business, as Eric Semler, you know, has previously called in the past, that may be generating a lot of free cash flow, but doesn't know what to do. Like, they're not growing very fast. They're not, you know, on the same growth rate as a big Mag 7 company or NVIDIA. And they're looking where to deploy capital. Like, they could do stock buybacks, they could do dividends, they could try to acquire another company or whatnot. If it doesn't beat the hurdle rate of Bitcoin, then arguably you should just buy Bitcoin. And so in that sense, I think we have a lot of capital allocators, whether that's an individual and you're like, I don't know where to invest that will beat Bitcoin, so therefore me as an individual, I Bitcoin. Or as a company, whether you're an existing shareholder or you're on the management team of the company, you're deciding, okay, I have this capital on my balance sheet that I need to allocate properly. If I can't find something that beats the hurdle rate of Bitcoin, I should just buy more Bitcoin. And so in that sense, it's like, almost every company should be buying Bitcoin, just like how every individual should probably be buying Bitcoin. And so, you know, in that sense, I don't necessarily see them competing against each other. But then it's also like the Bitcoin treasury companies that are like native and focused almost entirely on accumulating Bitcoin. In a way, you could argue that they're all competing for like similar pools of capital. You know, for example, if with my capital, I can buy Strategy, I can buy Strive, I can buy Metaplanet. And if I have $1, you know, I can't have the same $1 in all three companies. I wish I could, because that would be, I mean, I have $3, but if I only have $1, I got to pick where I put that $1. And so in that sense, you could argue it's kind of competing. But at the end of the day, I think the market size of Bitcoin is so small relative to the entire, you know, global wealth, whether you look at bonds, equities, money, real estate, you know, art, whatever else, it still has such a long ways to go that it's more so Bitcoin and Bitcoin treasury companies are competing with, you know, inferior traditional stores of value. And so that's kind of how I would think about it. It's definitely an interesting topic. But yeah, I mean, like you brought up how the last 6 months or so, or I guess, you know, 8 months or so have been like very rocky for Bitcoin treasury companies. And you know, that's a whole other topic that we can definitely get into. You know, at a high level, it's interesting because I think if you look back at 2025 and you saw arguably like the success of Strategy, or, you know, 2024 and 2025, you saw the success of strategies. You saw the success of a lot of Bitcoin treasury companies as they performed pretty well. And, you know, one way that I've kind of thought about it is the strategy worked so well that Strategy got bid to an extreme valuation. You know, a lot of companies got bid to an extreme valuation. It created the incentive for other people to go out and build their own Bitcoin treasury company. And so we had this, you know, supply rush to the market because of how good of an idea amplified Bitcoin, you know, potentially is. And so the market, you know, rushed to provide a solution for all of this demand that we saw in 2024 and 2025. And then, you know, Bitcoin doesn't always just go straight up, unfortunately. It's an extremely volatile asset. And so when Bitcoin is ripping, demand for amplified Bitcoin is, you know, off the charts. It arguably could be almost infinite. But when Bitcoin is not ripping and we had all of this, you know, incremental supply of amplified Bitcoin come to the market, well, now no one, you know, fewer people want to hold the amplified Bitcoin position. And, you know, that's part of what we saw, I think, over the last 6 to 8 months. It's not so, from my perspective, it's not so that the strategy is broken. I mean, at the end of the day, a lot of these companies are simply, you know, doing a carry trade on Bitcoin where they have a cost of capital that's lower than their expected future compound annual growth rate of Bitcoin. And, you know, if that's the case and it plays out over a long enough time horizon and you can weather the volatility, then arguably, you know, there's a reasonable case to be made that you would outperform spot Bitcoin with extremely high volatility. And that's what I think a lot of people are, you know, figuring out, that, you know, Bitcoin is incredibly volatile. Amplified Bitcoin is a whole nother animal.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, I agree with you there. But one thing that I will push back on you, maybe I'm speaking for the plebs out here, but I think the reason why, you know, maybe Danny asked that question, or, you know, people in the Bitcoin space view as these treasury companies competing against each other, is essentially they see Bitcoin as this scarce asset, right? That it is. And so they think, okay, well, I want to get and accumulate as much Bitcoin as possible. So this is why, you know, it is a competition, because there's a finite amount of resources. I mean, well, we can maybe get into like the gold and silver, what's going on in those markets in a bit. But, you know, I guess from that angle, you know, I mean, you were talking about maybe investor capital, you know, maybe only having like $1, which company do I invest in? But when you look at it from like the Bitcoin lens and that angle, you know, do you see it in that sense, or do you see it as just essentially, you know, companies are essentially saving their free cash flow in a better money? So there is no competition because you're just essentially saving in that better money. And so it's a better strategy just in general.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I definitely would say I see it both ways. It's like, yes, of course, I'd want to own way more Bitcoin than everyone else. And I as an individual and as a, you know, a corporation. And yeah, if there's only 21 million Bitcoin, obviously, you know, and I think the price of Bitcoin is going to go up significantly, then I better start stacking as much Bitcoin as I possibly can now while the price is potentially lower than it could be in the future. And I know that I have, you know, a certain share of 21 million. But also in the sense, like we talked about, it's like, okay, well, as a company, we currently have our existing resources. We just need to deploy our existing resources into maximizing the amount of Bitcoin that we can generate. You know, there's not, it, obviously, like, we want to keep accumulating as much as we possibly can, but, you know, we you can only do so much. You know, if we could buy all 21 million Bitcoin, we would buy all 21 million Bitcoin. But, you know, just there's just like realistic limitations to what you can do. But yeah, I think it's healthy competition. It's you know, it's like, it's similar also to like saying, okay, like, you as an individual, you haven't bought Bitcoin. Doesn't, like, just because other people have bought Bitcoin and own 19.8 million of the 21 million Bitcoin already, that doesn't mean you should just give up and be like, oh, well, you know, I can't win. I'm never going to get any serious amount of Bitcoin. Like, no, if you have zero Bitcoin, like, you probably need Bitcoin more than anybody else. And so I think that's kind of the point that I would make is like, okay, if you're a company that has zero Bitcoin, just like if you're an individual that has zero Bitcoin, you need some Bitcoin. Like, if you're most likely you have not been beating the hurdle rate of Bitcoin. And if so, you're losing money if Bitcoin is money. And so I don't want you to be losing money, and you shouldn't want to be losing money if you own a company. The purpose of the company should be to make money for shareholders. And if you're not beating the hurdle rate of Bitcoin, you should start deploying capital into Bitcoin so you stop losing money.
Yeah, I mean, that's all fair to say. Now, I want to get into another angle of this market, you know, because obviously we had Peter Schiff got his victory lap within this last year because of gold and the silver performance. So, you know, there has been a lot of hot topic or hot conversations around this because Bitcoiners, you know, the initial sale to Bitcoin was it's digital gold, right? But obviously we saw Bitcoin on a down year and we saw the precious metals absolutely rip. So, you know, what do you think of the market dynamics currently in Bitcoin and in the precious metals markets?
Yeah, the gold and silver market has been fascinating to watch, as I'm sure a lot of people have been paying attention. I mean, gold up, I guess, like over 100% the last 12 months, silver up like, I mean, I don't know, maybe like 200 something percent over the last 12 months. It's pretty incredible. I mean, part of me is, and I think a lot of Bitcoiners are disappointed in the sense that, you know, this is kind of the environment that people have been expecting. Like the quote unquote debasement trade has, you know, kind of been a popular phrase that people have used. And it's, you know, it's the idea that a lot of the typical Bitcoin macro people have been talking about, where the US is on kind of an unsustainable physical process. You know, Len Alden says the train has no brakes. The feds or the government's running, you know, absurd deficits. It has the entire nation is extremely over indebted, and it kind of ends one or two ways. Either the amount of debt in the system is so large that you default and we go into like a Great Depression, or more likely the money printer comes on to kind of ease the pain, but inflation and commodities could run hot. And I think that that's, you know, the market is starting to agree with that perspective that I think a lot of people in the Bitcoin space have been saying for a while. Yet gold's been the one running over the last, you know, 14 months, 13 months, and Bitcoin's kind of stalled out a little bit. And, you know, it's interesting to look at because it's like, okay, I think on a 5-year period, Bitcoin and gold are pretty neck and neck. Gold might be a little bit ahead at the moment, but pretty close together. On a 4-year period, I believe Bitcoin's ahead. On a 3-year period, Bitcoin might be ahead. And then even like a 2-year period, I think it's possible Bitcoin might be ahead. It's just like the 1-year/ you know, 15-month period. Like it's been kind of tough, and gold has just absolutely crushed Bitcoin over that period. And so, like, in a way, I would argue that, you know, Bitcoin's kind of just like taking a breather from the performance that it's done over the last, you know, 5-10 years. And you know, you also got to look back, like there were a lot of catalysts for Bitcoin right before the past 15 months. We had the ETFs approve, which arguably should have brought forth some demand. And, you know, it did. The price went up. We had the, you know, Trump getting elected, the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve executive order, like that brought forth some demand. And so like we kind of pulled forward possibly some demand that would have may have came later naturally, just as, you know, Bitcoin became more scarce and price started running and people learned about Bitcoin's superior monetary properties. But yeah, I mean, like, but gold has obviously just massively outperformed over the last 15 months. So it's hard to, it's frustrating, but I think it's really probably only a matter of time until it's Bitcoin's turn again. And I think that, you know, gold being as high as it is, I think it's now around 20x larger than the total market size of Bitcoin, which, you know, and we're going to keep mining more gold at around, you know, 1-2% per year. And Bitcoin's already less than 1% per year monetary inflation, obviously trending to zero over the long run. You know, there's a lot of potential upside for Bitcoin here, and it makes it a pretty compelling, interesting opportunity.
Yeah, it is interesting because I think I saw something where it's like the Fed or the central banks have increased their gold purchases about like 1-2%. And then the price has increased by 40%. So take that for what it is, even though the narrative is, you know, that people are buying the physical gold, not as much the ETF, and watching these precious metals go out. But you've had a plenty of interesting price predictions over your time in Bitcoin. I believe you're one by 2035. I don't want to misquote you, but I believe it's 10 million by Q1 of 2035. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's possible.
Okay. Well, let's dive into that. Did this actually, like, I guess, seeing the precious metals affirm your prediction, or has that made it change? Maybe you think it's increasing. Like, what do you think that the precious metals are, I guess, are screaming to the Bitcoin market?
I think it's definitely screaming that the thesis is directionally correct. I think right now, I mean, if you last measure that I've seen, like, is total global wealth maybe around $1 quadrillion. So $1,000 trillion. And you know, that's allocated across bonds, equities, real estate, number of different asset classes. And I think we're kind of at the peak of like this long-term debt cycle where there's a huge debt bubble. And so arguably almost everything is overvalued at this point. And people are just like pouring capital into, you know, all these different things because they know they can't hold cash because interest rates are fairly low, or they have been, you know, the last 5 years, or really last 15 years, I guess. But, and so all this capital is kind of just pushed into everything else at extreme valuations. And yet, like I talked about, we're at this phase where, okay, we're either going to default or print a bunch of money. And most likely it's going to be a volatile process, kind of edging between the two, but leaning towards printing money in the long run. I think that's kind of what we're seeing. And so I think that in this scenario where the money printer kind of continues to go burr, we'll see a rush towards scarce assets that are permissionless and without counterparty risk. And, you know, Peter Thiel had an interesting slide at a Bitcoin conference a while back that showed in 1980, when there was high inflation and gold was doing incredibly well, and it was the peak of the gold market, the total market capitalization of gold, or total market value of all gold, matched the total market capitalization of all US equities. And so if Bitcoin could just, you know, one, reach digital gold at this point, but two, or reach the parity with gold, that puts it around, last I checked actually, around $1.8 million per Bitcoin, which is, you know, pretty great. And then arguably, like I said, like you can make the argument that these scarce assets that can be held without counterparty risk are arguably incredibly undervalued still, even after the big run that gold has, measured in dollar terms. And so I think that that's one big kind of movement that's going on, like pushing capital into Bitcoin, just the current macro conditions. But two is the whole idea of like the Jeff Booth thesis of technology deflation and AI. Like, I think that that is really accelerating in a big way that, you know, a lot of normal people probably aren't paying too much attention to.
What if I told you you never had to sell your Bitcoin? Instead, you can borrow against it with Salt Lending. Why give up your hard-earned Bitcoin when you can unlock its value without letting it go? With Salt, you get secure Bitcoin collateralized loans with no credit checks, no prepayment fees, and best of all, no rehypothecation. Salt has had zero customer collateral losses since it launched. Salt was the first platform to offer Bitcoin collateralized loans starting way back in 2016. Today, they offer tailored options for both individuals and businesses. And now introducing Salt Shield, the no liquidation solution. No forced liquidations during the lifetime of your loan when you're enrolled with Salt Shield. This just launched at the Bitcoin conference in Las Vegas, and it is next level peace of mind. For Green Candle listeners only, head to saltlending.com/green-candle for this exclusive offer for your Bitcoin collateralized loan. You can get cash for your Bitcoin today. Salt Lending, secure, trusted, proven.
I think that that's going to probably keep happening, driving the real prices of basic goods and services lower, measured in dollars. You know, they probably will keep going up, you know, around the Fed's target CPI inflation rate. But in real terms, whether that's measured in S&P 500 or Bitcoin, I think the prices could start falling pretty significantly. And especially if AI and humanoid robots and, you know, all these other, and self-driving cars and so much, like, really do become very prominent and popular by 2035, then there's going to be this rush towards, you know, actually scarce assets, because we're creating abundance in almost everything, basic consumer goods. But we can't create an abundance of Bitcoin. It's the only thing that, no matter how intelligent humanity becomes or how much energy gets directed into Bitcoin mining because of the difficulty adjustment, we'll never be able to create more than 21 million Bitcoin. And so, you know, related to the $10 million price prediction in 2035 is that Jeff Booth technology deflation thesis, I think, also applies to our traditional store of value assets that we hold today. You know, I've been posting a chart of the annual mined production of gold over the last 200 years. It appears to be going in like a fairly exponential manner. And arguably gold is like one of the most scarce, you know, coveted assets that has preserved value pretty well over the last 50 years, obviously. And we're still figuring out via technology and more humans on the planet and so on and so forth and to mine more gold. And so I think that technology deflation thesis is going to dilute the wealth that's stored in gold by mining more gold. It's going to dilute the wealth that's stored in real estate because we're able to build more houses or build higher or even create more land. There's an island called Palm Jumeirah where tens of thousands of people now have or residents now have beachfront property because we literally have been able to create land, which is pretty, you know, something that you can't even fathom. But that's, you know, if you decide to store wealth in something, humanity is going to try to figure out a way to make more of that. And I think that that's going to accelerate as we approach 2035. And as people hold this $1 quadrillion worth of wealth in everything else other than Bitcoin, I think a lot of that is going to be trying to, one, realizing that they're probably getting diluted and that there might be a better store of value and that Bitcoin might be that best store of value, because no matter how smart we get or how much energy we're able to produce, we're not going to be able to make more than 21 million Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's interesting. I want to get into the AI and kind of like Jeff Booth's thesis, because you had a great piece here written the other day. But before we get to that, I mean, you talked a little bit about, you know, some of the other markets and the traditional stores of value. Obviously, we've seen Saylor come in and talk about how Bitcoin is going to take over the $300 trillion bond market, the $145 trillion fixed income market. And now he's talking about the $200 trillion credit market. Obviously, those aren't small numbers, to say the very least. But, you know, I'm curious, because, you know, you're kind of got your foot dipped into both the TradFi world and the Bitcoin world. How is those two worlds essentially colliding? And you know, how is Bitcoin being looked at as taking over some of these giant markets?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely happening. Like, one of the things that I always wanted someone to build, like in the Bitcoin space, and I still want people to build this, is like is what Saylor has been talking about, like with digital money. It's, you know, this idea of, okay, we have Bitcoin, which is arguably the super collateral, you know, incredibly has all these, the correct monetary properties, and it's liquid 24/7. It's portable. It's fungible. You know, it's incredible collateral. Issuing and arguably because it's incredible collateral, people should want to borrow against it, and people should want to lend dollars against it. If you happen to want to earn dollar yield, which obviously there's, you know, as a Bitcoiner, maybe you don't want that, but as you know, the fact that there's $300 trillion worth of wealth in bonds and $100 trillion worth of wealth in money, dollars and bank accounts and savings accounts and CDs and whatnot, like there's a lot of demand in the world for dollar-based yield. And I think that that's kind of exactly, you know, the one of the main innovations of Bitcoin treasury companies, being able to use Bitcoin as an asset on the balance sheet and then issue this, you know, idea of digital credit, which is effectively a dollar-based yield product. And, you know, it's in high demand because it's massively over-collateralized. You might have 2, 3, 4, 5 times the amount of Bitcoin on your balance sheet compared to the dollar-based IOUs that you've issued via this digital credit. And it's kind of a win-win for both because it's so over-collateralized. And if it's all issued via digital credit and there's no maturity, then arguably it's even less riskier. But obviously there's a lot of demand for this idea of digital credit. And there's also a lot of demand for this idea of digital equity, which is like just taking the other side of that trade, borrowing the dollars and buying additional Bitcoin, the amplified Bitcoin position. So it kind of becomes like this win-win for both. And arguably this digital credit idea of people who want dollar-based yield, with a higher return at lower risk, you know, there's a pretty clear argument to be made that digital credit is providing that. And the success of Strategy, obviously, has in 2025, when they just started issuing digital credit, you know, I think it was like some of the largest IPOs of the entire year were just Strategy's digital credit products. And so I think that it's evidence that the market is really excited about this, both retail investors and both institutional investors too. And I think that, like, you know, if we're looking at the bond market and it's, you know, $300 trillion, you know, we're not going to wake up tomorrow and trillions of dollars are going to be in digital credit, unfortunately. But I think over time, as the Strategy and other companies that issue digital credit, you know, continue to make the dividend payments, Bitcoin continues to like just not die. Bitcoin simply just continues to not die and goes up slowly or goes up at this, you know, rates that Bitcoiners might expect, then I think this concept of digital credit will become a lot more acceptable in the institutional world, maybe after like 2-3 year track record of, you know, being massively over collateralized and continuing to make the dividend payments. Then I think a lot of capital will be able to trust it, just like in the early days of Bitcoin. You know, it's like you can argue that Bitcoin wasn't like a serious thing until 2020 when Saylor bought it. I mean, like 2017 bull market was pretty good and pretty exciting, and 2013 as well. But like 2013, Bitcoin was still arguably just like a toy. 2017, it was kind of becoming like, you know, niche Silicon Valley, like Coinbase was obviously like really exploding at that time. But it was still like, you know, for the most part, and there weren't very many serious people that, you know, were storing a lot of value in Bitcoin. But then Saylor, in 2020, when you had a large public corporation decide to buy hundreds of millions of dollars of Bitcoin, that was kind of like a step change in like the way that the world seriously looked at Bitcoin. And I think that that's kind of progressed in a positive manner probably every year since then.
Yeah. And I think, the way that Saylor has kind of like, I guess, intertwined himself with the TradFi world is really interesting. And, you know, you look around, you know, with his development of meeting with all these big giant money pools of capitals, essentially in different countries. I mean, obviously he was just in Abu Dhabi. He's been spotted in Brazil. And then coincidentally, 6 months later, Brazil was talking about a Bitcoin strategic reserve. So it seems like everywhere he goes, it's essentially just making it more bullish for Bitcoin and more people are seeing the light. On that note, how influential do you think he's been when it's come to just the traditional financial world and I guess seeing the light of Bitcoin?
I think he's been very influential. I mean, I think he's, you know, looking back at Bitcoin history, there's not like one person, I think, that, you know, other than Satoshi, I guess, but there's not one person that, you know, was required to make Bitcoin successful. I think Bitcoin was kind of this like code that was dropped into the world. And it, in a way, it's like a digital organism. And like, you know, the nodes are kind of like the cells and the humans are running the nodes and holding private keys. They're like, you know, part of the organism. And, you know, if you look back over the years, like no one really knew what Bitcoin was necessarily going to become. And it was going to become probably whatever it was going to become without any single one person deciding what it should be. Because it's this decentralized network. This is like decentralized organism that exists on the internet. And so like when you're talking about like, you know, Saylor, like where would Bitcoin be without him? Or like how influential is Saylor on getting TradFi to adopt Bitcoin? I think he's been incredibly influential. And I think it's interesting to think of like where Bitcoin would be like without him right now. And I think it'd still be fine. But I think he's probably been definitely one of the most influential people in the Bitcoin space. And I think he's done an incredible job of kind of convincing, you know, older pools of capital or more like institutional pools of capital to like say, like, hey, like, you know, this digital internet money thing, it's actually real. And there's actually a pretty valid use case for it. It's objectively, if you look at its monetary properties, it's a better form of money. And if we're right about that, then, you know, this could be worth a lot of money and it could have an incredible future compound annual growth rate and you should allocate capital to it. So I think he knows that, right? Like I think in the early days, you know, he was going on like every single Bitcoin podcast almost to talk about it, which was pretty cool. And, you know, he still loves making presentations and talking about Bitcoin. And so I think he's been personally, I think he's been a great voice for Bitcoin, both from like a retail perspective, but also from like an institutional perspective.
Yeah, 100%. I'm trying to get the nickname going, Hard Money Mike, to get that that coined on. But, you know, I think I'm the only one really saying it. Maybe I'll get you on it now, Joe. But I mean, when we see the TradFi world just kind of intertwining, and then now, especially with the takeoff of the gold markets, I think it's really interesting. But I mean, we brought up earlier the kind of the intertwining with AI and kind of that, you know, new thesis, right? Jeff Booth's been knocking the door down with this thesis of, you know, essentially AI and then Bitcoin essentially making everybody more efficient and, you know, essentially being able to live our lives a little bit more free. So, you know, you wrote just a great piece here the other day. So why don't you dive into that thesis and how you see AI and the Bitcoin world starting to play out? Last bull run, we had exchanges blow up. You saw FTX, Celsius, BlockFi, you name it. But the true power of Bitcoin is getting it off an exchange into cold storage. This bull run, I'm trusting Trezor, the company that's been around for over a decade, and they just had a brand new release of the best hardware wallet in the game, the Trezor Safe 7. It's got the first audible secure element. No other hardware wallet has this. On top of it, I travel a lot, so I need an easy way to connect my Bitcoin hardware wallet to my laptop, phone, what have you. Therefore, it is the easiest way and has the best connectivity to access your Bitcoin. This is truly how you become your own bank, and the best way to do that is with a Trezor Safe 7. So you could go to the affiliate link down below and get yourself one right now, and do it quickly because they are flying off the shelves, folks. So do it with the easiest and best way to get your Bitcoin off exchanges. So go to the affiliate link down below get yourself a Trezor Save 7, and get your Bitcoin off exchanges in the easiest way possible. All right, enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, it's anyone that's been, I think, playing around with the AI tools, you know, kind of knows that this is a really big new technology that humans have unlocked, right? And part of what inspired me to write this, the article, is you'll have people like Elon Musk, who I greatly respect, but he'll go out and say things like, in the future, we won't necessarily need money because AI and robotics and whatnot has unlocked a period of total abundance. And I think that, like, it's interesting. It's, you know, it's hard to conceptualize what the future really will look like as we go into this concept of the singularity and, you know, AI just, you know, becomes, you know, 1,000 times more intelligent than Albert Einstein. And we have billions of them working 24/7, 365 around the clock to hopefully make the world a better place. Like it gets kind of, yeah, reflexive, and, you know, it's hard to predict what exactly is going to happen, but assume that, you know, it's going to be good. And we're going to be able to create an abundance of almost everything. I still think we need to get from where we are today to here to there, because we're obviously not, you know, today there's, you know, people are starving, you know, a lot of people feel like they're struggling, you know, people in America, and I imagine all around the world, you know, feel like they can't even really afford a house, especially at least my, you know, my generation. And so I think that we're very, very far, or we feel to be very, very far from this period of abundance. And so as we merge from where we are today to this abundance phase, which could be actually pretty soon because AI is advancing so fast, or we could be progressing towards it very soon. We may not ever reach this idea of total abundance, but it's hard to argue that we're not like on the path or trajectory toward that in a very fast manner. And so it relates to kind of what I was talking about earlier, where it was like, okay, this going towards this abundance, Jeff Booth has done an incredible job of explaining technology deflation thesis of, okay, very easy to see how, you know, your basic goods and services will be, you know, very affordable and get more affordable over time, if not free. Like an example that I've used in the past is like when calculators first came out, you know, however many years ago, well, somewhat modern calculators at least, came out, you know, I don't know, 50 years ago or so, like they were actually expensive, and they'd sit on your desk and they'd be pretty big. And it may cost, you know, a few hundred bucks to buy one. Now it's like everyone gets a calculator on their own phone, and it's free. The app to download the calculator is free, and it could actually have more features. It can be a scientific calculator, a financial calculator, or whatnot. They're all free. So it's easy to conceptualize something like that as being deflationary in a sense, but it's hard to conceptualize like the next phase of what I think still is happening. And it's the idea that our assets that we hold today are also, like, you know, subject to this idea of technology deflation. A super obvious example, I think, at this point is something like software as a service, where, you know, vibe coding is now becoming like the popular thing to do on X at least, or Twitter. And arguably, if it continues, and it may already be here to some extent, where you can say, hey, my business needs a website or a CRM or whatever, and it builds it for you, and it builds it to your exact everything that you want, all of your specs that you're requesting, and it can build. And therefore, why would you go out and pay $1,000 a month, or if you're a corporation, $500,000 a month, or millions of dollars a year for this software as a service, when you can tell, you know, an AI system to build it, and it builds it, and then you own it, and you can customize it as much as or as little as you want. And so it's like, in that sense, if you are an individual that's storing wealth in the NASDAQ, or, you know, big basket of technology companies, software as a service companies, well, technology deflation isn't just affecting the calculator that's on your phone and making that free. Technology deflation is eating at the wealth that where you've stored all of your wealth, which is a little bit concerning. If that's where you're storing, you know, 100% of your wealth. And like I said, you know, earlier, like it applies to gold. Like, we're able to mine a lot more gold. I think like last year, we maybe mined like 100 times more gold, humanity as a whole, mined 100 times more gold than we did in the year like 1800. And so like we're, you know, that's 200 year period, but we're getting a lot more productive at creating even the most scarce things in the world. And I think that we have all this wealth in these, what we think are scarce things in the world, software service companies, gold, real estate, or whatnot. But as AI advances faster and faster, and we head towards this idea of total abundance, which Elon Musk and others in the AI space think we're going towards, well, everything becomes abundant except for a monetary asset like Bitcoin, because you can't make more of it. And so in a way, if you take it out to the extreme, it's like it's almost hard to keep wealth outside of Bitcoin as we head out to this period of total abundance. Because if you keep wealth in a software as a service company, and the software as a service company is worth $1 billion, well, people are going to be, you know, vibe coding your software as a service company and undercutting your margins and trying to suck that $1 billion of market cap that you have in your software as a service company into some of their company. And they don't care if they get, you know, $100 million. They just want to, you know, keep sucking wealth out of what humanity has already stored wealth in. And so the more wealth we store in all these other assets, the greater incentive it is for AI and robotics and other humans to dilute that wealth and to try to take it and to build a better service or more efficient service. And so in that sense, it's like, okay, we have all this wealth outside of Bitcoin. The wealth really needs to be in Bitcoin, because that's the one place where we can't dilute any of the wealth.
Yeah, it's interesting that you said all that about the SaaS companies, because I've been, ever since I discovered vibe coding, I've been telling people that I think SaaS is just dead, because exactly like you lined out here. I mean, I made a dashboard to do some of like my social media analytics in an afternoon. So, I mean, like, you know, ordering something like that or getting somebody to do that used to take like months. And now, you know, it takes just a few hours to build things like that. And like you said, it could be essentially customized for everything. So I think it's a really interesting development. But, you know, the Bitcoin and the scarce asset, you know, I guess let's dive into the Elon Musk thesis, because I mean, obviously I've heard him say that, but I'm curious kind of how you think that world looks, because I see a couple different ways where essentially, you know, we've seen Bitcoin, I guess, develop a lot over time. And part of that development has been intertwining with people, how they're saving and everything else, but having a money where there, or having a world where there's no money, that just, you know, everybody says if we were on the hard money standard, we would be in this like utopia and we'd have flying cars. So how do you think that this world playing out would be with, you know, the development of AI and essentially no money?
Yeah. So it's like, it's such an interesting question. I mean, like I said, I think like if you get to the point where we have trillions of Albert Einsteins and they're all working 24/7, it's hard to predict what's going to happen. So I think we're heading towards that world. And so maybe Elon, you know, you could make the argument that Elon is right in the sense that, like, maybe very far into the future.
This bull run, I'm looking for ways to stack Bitcoin in my sleep, and mining has always caught my eye. I've partnered with the guys over at Simple Mining to help you do just that. I don't recommend anything that I don't use personally, so I've got a machine up and running with them right this second. And they've even opened the facility up so anyone can go and visit. They manage over 15,000 machines for 500 clients, handling all of the maintenance and repairs so you don't have to. And for the Green Candle listeners, they're giving an exclusive offer: all the repairs for the first year for free. So if you've been thinking about mining, head on over to simplemining.io/greencandle to get this exclusive offer and learn about the potential tax benefits that you can get from mining with Simple Mining. All right, enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
Maybe like money is not a concept, but I think we are not there yet. And I think we're pretty far away from that, unfortunately or fortunately, I'm not really sure. But like in the sense of like the calculator app example, it's like well, how much money or how much Bitcoin do you need to buy a calculator app? It's like, it's free. I mean, you just download the app. And so money is kind of like, in certain things, money has kind of already become irrelevant because the winner was the consumer that received something for free, or Google, right? I mean, like, as long as you have an internet, like, you don't pay for Google, it's free. You indirectly maybe pay for ads, through ads, but like, you know, you still, a lot of people still use Google, or before ChatGPT and everything else, you still use Google. But like, again, I think that, we're heading towards this idea of abundance. So I don't even know if we'll ever like make it to where money itself is not relevant. And I think as we go from where we are today to towards that potential state, which may not ever exist, because there might always be things that are obviously like artificially scarce. Like, yes, at Palm Jumeirah, we created additional beachfront property, but for whatever reason, if you want to live on Miami Beach at the house right next to Michael Saylor, you know, there's only one of those, or there's only two of those, I guess, because he's got two neighbors. But like there will like, humans will probably always create some form of artificial scarcity. And I think Bitcoin is obviously like the best form of scarcity that's digital and is a good form of money, which is important. But as we go towards this idea of, you know, of abundance we'll still have some form of scarcity. Like, I mean, right now, like, common scarcity is obviously like real estate for younger people. People want to be able to afford like a relatively normal house. Like, that is still scarce. And so I think Bitcoin as a tool is going to help people unlock that future scarcity, that they may seem today like, oh, I'll never be able to buy this or afford this. Bitcoin is a better savings tool than everything else that exists. And so therefore, if you say Bitcoin and AI and free markets just continue functioning, it'll create technology deflation in those things that you might want, or something very close to what you might want. And that'll like help you, you know, reach those goals. So yeah, I think like I think Elon like jumps a bunch of steps when he arrives to, oh, we won't need money in a certain amount of time. I think that we got to get to that point first. And I think Bitcoin is a very useful tool to help us help you as an individual or a corporation get to that point, because arguably it's the world's best savings technology. And maybe we never reach that point because there may always be artificial scarcity.
Now, you brought up real estate. Obviously, like, our generation is looking at it as a different way, right? I mean, essentially we've seen TradFi come in and financialize housing, which is done a disservice to the younger generations. And I think the average age of like a first time home buyer now is getting closer and closer to 40. So it seems like the American dream is somewhat dead. How do you see, or I guess the traditional American dream that as we know it, the white picket fence and the house and all of that, how do you see real estate, I guess, playing out here, with the evolution of Bitcoin? You know, obviously there's a bunch of new products coming out that you can combine the equity with some Bitcoin, some different tactics that way. But how do you see, I guess, just overall the real estate market as it is right now and projecting a little bit further here?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because you make a great point of like, okay, real estate in the US and around the world has been financialized, to a large extent. And I would argue like what that means is like, it's been monetized, you know, our money is broken. Most people, whether you frame it in that way or you don't frame it that way, it's kind of what has happened, where you pour your wealth into other assets that are not the dollar, not dollars, because you know, dollars are going to be debased over time. And so real estate has obviously been a very popular way to store wealth. And I think that creates obviously a lot of negative externalities. Right? One, you're saving in real estate, driving up the price for people that actually like need the real estate for their house, to live in, or to start a family or whatnot. And then not only that, I would argue that if we had a better money, because everyone has pushed up the price of real estate so high that you're buying real estate at high valuations currently, if we had a better money, you could probably, which is Bitcoin, I would argue you could probably just buy Bitcoin instead of buying the house. And in that way, you have a better total long-term total return than buying a real estate at a price that doesn't make any sense. And the price of housing should go down because less people are incentivized to buy housing if they know that there's a superior alternative to store wealth in Bitcoin. And then housing gets more affordable. So I think, like, you know, I don't, obviously that won't happen overnight. You know, a lot of people will probably continue holding houses because for a number of different reasons. But I do think that over time, as the AI thesis plays out and technology advances and we build more houses, we build more apartment complexes, it and Bitcoin continues functioning and simply doesn't break, it'll become more clear over time that hoarding real estate is not, you know, it's not outperforming Bitcoin. It's not beating the hurdle rate of Bitcoin. And as people begin to recognize that, okay, like, I've been using the dollar as my unit of account for a long time. I bought this house for $50,000 decades ago. Now it's worth $500,000, you know, 5 years, maybe it's worth $1 million. Like, maybe like the house didn't go up 20x in decades. Maybe it's like the dollar just went down. And I think people are going to start to realize, like, maybe there's a better form of money. And then they'll realize, like, wait, like, I bought this, you know, I had this house in 2026 and it was worth, you know, 6 Bitcoin, 7 Bitcoin. And now it's worth 1 Bitcoin. Like, I lost, you know, 5 to 6 Bitcoin over the last 5 years because the house is, you know, Bitcoin one is a better form of money. It's being, and it's actively being adopted right now. 2, it's getting more scarce over time. And 3, like, you know, the house breaks, like, you got to update things. You got to pay property taxes. You got to do maintenance. Like, it's, and, you know, and we're building more houses. Like, we're diluting, you know, your share of total wealth that's stored in real estate.
One of my absolute favorite things about Bitcoin is meeting all of you in person. So mark your calendars for February 28th and come down to where I've called home for the past 8 years, Tampa, Florida. The Bitcoin Bay Foundation is putting on the Sound Money Soiree. It's the 3rd annual. It's a night of Bitcoin, poker, an open bar, and a silent auction. All support will go to Bitcoin Bay, a nonprofit that is creating a circular economy down in Tampa Bay, Florida. They're doing absolutely great things, and it's the Bitcoin community that I've called home for such a long time, and these guys are absolutely crushing it. So please do anything you can to support. Buy your tickets today. You can use promo code GREENCANDLE to get 10% off your Sound Money Soiree tickets.
So do you know anything about Bitcoin?
No.
You guys can come down and see this ugly mug. Come boogie on the dance floor, shake it, and now that Bitcoin's over 100K, you can do it all with your girlfriends. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show.
So I think it's going to be probably like a fairly gradual process. And I think real estate will probably get more affordable, certainly measured in Bitcoin, if I had to guess. And I think that that's going to be good for the younger generation that saves in Bitcoin, or anyone that saves in Bitcoin. And I think that the people that recognize that Bitcoin is a better form of money will have better, you know, financial returns by not storing a bunch of wealth in houses and saving Bitcoin instead. And that, like you said, you pointed out, there's products now that, you know, make it easy for people to kind of like extract some equity that they have in their house and put it into Bitcoin, which I think is great. But, you know, arguably, if, you know, it might still be better to just sell the house and buy Bitcoin. But again, not, you know, there might not be enough people that would be willing to do that. So it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely like one of those areas where everybody kind of wants the security, right? Having something that they quote unquote own. But, you know, when obviously as Bitcoiners, we know when you break it down, the property taxes, all of that, do you really own it? But I think the one interesting part of real estate still is the amount of leverage, you know, the amount that at least in the United States, you can put just like 3.5% down on your first time house and everything like that. But we are seeing banks start to get into the Bitcoin space. So I guess tell me your overall view on the banking system, like how they're starting to get into Bitcoin. Do you think it's maybe out of necessity. They see, you know, more people going towards Bitcoin and getting out of banks, or do you see it as they see it maybe as a way to make money? Like, how do you view, or how do you think that the banks and the traditional banking system looks at Bitcoin right now?
Yeah, I mean, this is a interesting topic with like a probably a number of different avenues, because it's to talk about, because you have, you know, banks, one, like how get into Bitcoin, how so? There's like a number of ways that they could get into Bitcoin or Bitcoin adjacent things. And I think like the current market structure bill that's, I guess, being debated in the United States right now is related to stable coins. And like, should stable coins be able to provide yield? Obviously, the existing banking system is kind of advocating against that, because if stable coins provide yield and they hold T-bills and they pay the highest interest rate compared to, you know, all of the deposits on their bank accounts that are currently outstanding, there's and stable coins are arguably better from like a payments perspective, then it makes a lot of sense to just be like, okay, why would anyone have a bank account if you can have stablecoin, which is more portable, pays a higher yield than a bank account, probably has less people, like less counterparties involved, honestly, as well. So that's like one thing that's kind of interesting too, is like, okay, are banks going to start custodying Bitcoin? I would argue that they, you know, some, as far as I know, like are working on things like that. And it seems like that would be, inevitable that they're going to try to do something like that. And then the third thing is, will banks, you know, so like the business model of a bank is you have your liabilities, which are customer deposits, i.e. if you have $100,000 in your account, the bank owes you $100,000. But the bank has assets to obviously backing that $100,000. And it's not usually cash. It's normally credit. It's normally T-bills. It's normally your neighbor's mortgage. It could be your mortgage. It could be corporate debt. It could be, in the future, digital credit, which I think is also kind of interesting. It's like, okay, well, banks buy credit and they back your deposits with that credit. Bitcoin treasury companies are issuing digital credit and they hold a lot of Bitcoin on their balance sheet. Arguably, digital credit, if you're still into dollar yield, which banks obviously are very much so, banks arguably could be some of the biggest buyers of digital credit. And I think, you know, that's why Saylor gave that presentation in Abu Dhabi, trying to encourage someone to go out there and build digital money, basically a bank that issues dollar deposits backed by digital credit, rather than T-bills or mortgages or whatnot. So I think, yeah, like this is where probably the banking system is going to be colliding with Bitcoin in a way. And some, you know, some banks are probably going to be resisting it, realizing that this is a huge, you know, disruption to their business. But I also think some are probably going to realize that the creative destruction is inevitable and they should be, you know, forward thinking, and they could benefit from it by attracting a lot of Bitcoin as deposits, or, you know, juicing their returns by selling mortgages and buying digital credit. So it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. You know, some jurisdictions probably are going to be restrictive and worried about banks getting involved with Bitcoin. And then other jurisdictions are going to be encouraging probably banks to get involved with Bitcoin. And, you know, I hope the United States decides to be on the side of being like a more progressive towards Bitcoin and encouraging banks to, you know, not take absurd risk, but to open, you know, their products and services and their balance sheet to Bitcoin and Bitcoin adjacent products.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, I mean, there's obviously been the rumors floating around of like the coordinated attack of MSTR on JP Morgan and kind of, you know, the stablecoin issue with banks. So I guess, do you think that, I guess, does it worry you maybe in the short term that when these banks start to come in and I guess financialize or attempt to financialize Bitcoin, that we're going to see like more volatile times? Like, do you think that that was partially the reason why we saw maybe a negative 25 when it came to the Bitcoin price action, even though we had so much bullish news? Like, do you think it's going to be, I guess, more of the Wild West type of market just because like these big money players are starting to come in?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, One of the probably like unpopular opinions that I have in general is that, you know, people say Bitcoin's volatility is declining, which is historically very accurate. However, the case for future volatility to expand is there's a lot of different cases to be made for that to happen, whether that's the upside or to the downside in the short term. And I think that, yeah, like there could be, you know, fights between the banking industry and quote unquote, the Bitcoin industry, you know, certain parts of the banking industry. And that could be, you know, have a negative short-term impact on Bitcoin. There's also catalyst for that to be a very positive short-term impact on Bitcoin. It's hard to really tell. But yeah, I definitely think that more volatility could certainly be on the table. But it's hard to know if that's going to be the case for sure. And I'm not, you know, one to bet on short-term price movements because I think it's almost unpredictable to figure out exactly, you know, how the banking system and how specific people in the banking system are going to, you know, react to Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, that's all fair to say. It is kind of a variable, I guess, you know, I mean, when humans get involved, Jamie Dimon and all that, you know, Larry Fink, all of these guys, when we see them start to backpedal seemingly on Bitcoin, seems like they're going to start to embrace it, but I guess time will tell and we shall see. But Joe, you've been very generous with your time. So why don't you tell everybody what you're working on and where else they can find out more of your great content?
Yeah. Well, thanks, Brandon, for having me on. This is an awesome conversation. Always enjoy your podcast. Obviously I work at Strive right now. So if you want to learn more about Strive, you can, you know, find Strive on Twitter. Or search us on Google. You can find me on Twitter and YouTube as well. Just type in Joe Burnett Bitcoin and it should pop up. But thanks for having me on. This was fun.
Yeah, man. I'll put all that in the show notes. Everybody go check out Joe and his great content and read his latest article as well. It's got great insights on Bitcoin and AI. And Joe, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you guys all for tuning in to another great episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you found some value in this one, please hit that subscribe button and that like button to help send this one to the masses. And I've got a surprise for you guys. I've got two more episodes that you have the chance to watch here. So go ahead and click one of them and I'll see you guys all at the next one.